Dinners by the fireplace in warm wood ambience. Silver Creek offers over 100 of the world's finest wines and draft beers. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, featuring the Subaru Forester 2.5X, the small SUV with four-wheel independent raised suspension, all-wheel drive, and four-wheel ABS standard. Information at 217-352-8910 for Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is hour number two. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. See, Jason's been on the last few days, and I'm just used to looking up and seeing him out there. In this part of Focus 580, we are happy to have here on the show with us our chief meteorologist, Ed Kieser, to talk a little bit about weather. Now, I suppose if you're like me, I think there are a lot of people maybe who think that it feels like it's been winter for a long time, but it is now actually climatological spring, and we'll have the equinox here not too long, and eventually we're going to get into warmer temperatures, and when we get into spring, we will start to have severe thunderstorms and the possibility of tornadoes. So this is, in fact, it may be surprising, but this is, in fact, the week that's been set aside by officials both in Illinois and Indiana to encourage people to think about what they would do in the event of severe weather. It's time to review your plans and know if you're in your house where you're going to go and if you're somewhere out in public where you're going to go. So when we come to these times of the year, we generally ask Ed to come in and talk a little bit about severe weather, and we can talk a little bit about spring storms and how they're formed and how they're tracked and what you should do if you find a tornado headed your way. Any and all of that is certainly welcome. And if people do have questions about weather, the way it works, and weather forecasting, I know Ed would do his best to give you an answer. I just want to make sure that people understand that this is not talk to. We can't give you a forecast if you're traveling. We're going to do that tomorrow, like we usually do. But this is a different kind of thing. And actually, what's, I think, been interesting for listeners and for Ed, too, is that it is a chance to talk a little bit about weather and how it works. So those kinds of questions, they are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Thanks very much.
It's good to be here.
If you wouldn't mind my asking a kind of a general question about the winter that's now officially done, it does seem to me that temperatures on average have been running cold, and that it's actually for us compared to the past few years, it's been pretty wet. We've gotten a fair amount of snow and also rain. The precip has been pretty good.
Well, the precip were in most stations in central Illinois ranked in the top five wettest winters of all time, and in some cases as high as second wettest. So in that regard, it was, any way you slice it, a wet winter, and that includes all precipitation, rain, and snow. It was nowhere near record-breaking in terms of snowfall around here. A lot of the precipitation we got was in the form of rain, including some of the flooding rains that occurred in early January, around January 7th into the 8th, when Watseka had the devastating flood, and they've had some other smaller floods since then, and we're not out of the woods yet on that, but it has been a wet winter. As far as temperature, the departure is probably not as big as some may think, because we did have some warm episodes in the first half of climatological winter. Really, it wasn't until this past month that we were colder than average day after day after day after day, and we've been stuck in that pattern for a while with very few days that were above average, this past Sunday being one of them. But we're right back down again, and next few days are going to be quite chilly.
Yeah. When I do have the chance to look at weather maps, it does seem to me that there have been a number of times, maybe particularly in the last month, where when you look at what's happening with the jet stream, there are these big troughs that go down into the central part of the country, bringing a lot of cold air down into the Midwest.
Well, this winter, the Arctic was very cold, and there's a large coverage of snow cover across the northern hemisphere, and actually the snow cover reached its greatest extent since those really cold winters of the late 1970s. So in many ways, it was a more classical winter around here. Although we did have those warm episodes in between the cold, so it wasn't the bitter winters. It didn't come close to comparing with the late 70s, because and some of those winters we were cold for. Well, the entire month of January of 77, it was just downright cold.
Yeah, I remember. I was here then. It was cold. And of course, that was in the old days of the old wind chill. But still, it was still cold.
Cold is cold.
Cold is cold. That's right. And it does seem that this winter we have had some unusual bounces in temperature, where we might, maybe for one day, have unusually mild weather. I think, and I'm not sure what this day was, but I remember the day was, I think it was a Monday, when around midday it was maybe in the 60s, and then by 5 o'clock it had dropped below freezing.
Yeah, that happens quite
Monday
a bit. We've had over the last, I could say, couple decades, more of those warm days than we used to have in winter. So that's something that maybe it's anecdotal, because I don't have all the numbers in front of me to back it up. But I think that's one thing that we've noticed with climate change, and whether it's permanent in that way or will change some more in another way, I don't know. But we've had more of those warm winter days than in the past. And really, the winters have trended to be on the warmer side than the summers over the last couple of decades. When you look at the bigger picture, it seems like there's been more of a change in our winter than summer. And over the course of a year, a bigger change in our overnight low temperatures being warmer than our daytime highs, too. So it's not a uniform change. Huh. But that's just... and snowfall, of course, over the last 20 years or so, most years have been below average on snowfall. But snowfall is different every year. There's a large standard deviation, if you want to get statistical, on snowfall, because some years you just get a couple big storms and that you get a really high spike. And then there's a lot of other years where you just don't get a lot.
Yeah. Well, weather questions are welcome, particularly here we're talking about the kind of severe weather that we will be getting into here as temperatures warm and we get more things like thunderstorms and tornadoes. But other weather questions, they're welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Are there people who do forecasts, long-range forecasts for the potential for severe weather, that is, you know, tornadoes and thunderstorms? And I know, for example, there are people who try to do that for hurricanes. And, you know, there's some question about how good those forecasts are. But for that, are there people who say, okay, in March, April, May, we predict that there will be so many tornadoes?
I don't see any official forecast for that. There have been some people that have written some papers showing some statistical studies, but comparing, first of all, hurricane forecasting with tornado forecasting, and neither is easy to do long range. But hurricane forecasting, in terms of number of storms, let's say, is a little bit easier, because anything that you can do long range, you have to look to the oceans, because the oceans are warm and cool much more slowly than land. So there are big storage units of heat. And if you notice pockets of unusually warm or unusually cold water in the oceans, you know that they're not going to change on the dime. And you can make some inferences based on that several months out. And in fact, all the climate forecasts we get several months out, which over time become less and less accurate, and most of the time when we're at this point in the year looking to summer, they'll just say an equal chances of above average, near average, or below average temperature and precipitation, because there's really just not enough to go on. Those forecasts are a little more accurate. There's a little more accuracy near the oceans, especially near the tropical oceans. So the hurricane forecasts aren't always right, but they do have something to go on. here in the U.S., tornadoes form in the middle of the continent, and there's a lot of variables. So really, a good forecast can't be made. Having said that, though, there are some that have said statistically there's a bump up in severe weather frequency in years coming off of La Nina. And we're coming off of La Nina in the Pacific Ocean. And so we're a little bit on guard right now because of that. Now, when it comes right down to it, a lot of ingredients have to come together to produce severe weather. So it could end up being a quiet season or a very active season. Usually, in most seasons, it just comes down to a couple days to a couple of weeks where the pattern is such that everything gets going. But with La Nina, they're just how that affects the jet stream and all, there might be a little tilt in the odds toward a more active severe weather season. Mm-hmm. But it's not statistically significant to the point where you can take money to the bank on it.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the things always, I'm sure always we talk about, or always I ask you to talk about, is a little bit about the dynamics, the things that go into making severe storms. And I guess it is the way I think about it classically, it's the clash of warm, moist air with cold, drier air. Where those things come together, you're going to get storms.
Yeah, that's pretty much the way to look at it. It's the clash of the air masses. It of course, is a little more complicated than that, but that's how you that look at it. And basically, you do need to have the warm, moist air because that's the fuel for the thunderstorms. And when the winds start blowing from the Gulf of Mexico up into the Central Plains in the Midwest, that's the fuel for the thunderstorms. Yet in the springtime especially, we still have the cold, dry air coming out of Canada. And part of what makes that clash of air masses important is the jet stream aloft is stronger when there's a bigger north-to-south temperature difference. So the jet stream over time going into summer gets weaker. So you still get severe storms, but your classic big tornadoes are not as frequent in the mid to late summer as they are, say, late March through April and May. So that clash of the air masses is there to help keep the jet stream strong. So basically you need the warm, moist air, the fuel for the storms, and then you need wind shear. That's the change of direction and speed of the wind as you go up in the atmosphere. And when you have a strong jet stream aloft, you have that change in wind speed. And also typically you'll have winds out of the south to southeast at the surface, but more out of the southwest to west aloft. So you get that turning with height. So thunderstorms that form have this rotation, which can lead to the increased rotation near the updraft of the storm where the tornado forms. So you can get pretty complex on it, but the bottom line is springtime is the prime time because we have the strong jet stream and the clash of the air masses. But we also have the longer days because the logical question is why don't we get all this in the fall as well? Because we have the clash of the air masses going into winter. And we do sometimes see a little spike in severe weather in November. But the big difference between April and November is that the days are much longer and getting longer in April, and the sun is getting higher in the sky, so you get more solar heating to warm the ground to cause that warm, moist air to become warmer and lighter and rise, because that's the other thing. And to get the storms to form, you have to have the air rising. You need an unstable atmosphere, and you get that with more quickly with the solar heating, which is most pronounced, obviously, as we get into the high sun angle, longer day time of year. So you max out on the long days, the high sun angle, and the strongest jet stream, the combination of those factors from about now through April and May.
Yeah, and that heating that you get, particularly it gets more and more throughout the day. So I suppose that's also part of the reason that, generally speaking, where you get your storms, they're going to be really in the mid to late afternoon because you've had that chance of the air heating up all through
the day. Exactly. The prime time for tornadoes is around 5-6 o'clock in the evening on average. You can get them at any time of the day or night. Want to point that out,
Right. But, and we certainly be, we've certainly seen them. We've seen them particularly very tragically damaging storms that come at night.
That's true.
Or in the middle of the night when people are asleep and they maybe don't get notice, and that's when it can be really, really, really seriously damaging, because people it happens and it's on you before you know it.
And as we go through the show here, we could talk about how to take care of nighttime storms.
Right. Okay. Well, we have a couple of callers here, and let me again introduce our guest, Ed Kieser. He's our chief meteorologist for WILL, and we're talking a little bit about severe storms. This is the time of the year when it's time to start thinking about the storms. They won't be all that long before we're talking about severe thunderstorms and the chance of tornadoes. This is, in fact, Severe Storm Preparedness Week, both in Illinois and in Indiana. We have a caller here, someone to talk with in East Peoria. This is line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting show. A couple of quick questions for Ed, and I'll go ahead and take my answers off the air. I had a discussion with some of my friends with regards to urban areas and discussion about whether or not a city like Chicago could ever take a direct hit with a tornado, and arguments about, no, the urban heat island, and so on and so forth. And I said, no, a tornado could hit anywhere. Chicago's just been unusually lucky. I mean, if you think about it, the downtown area taking a hit at 5 o'clock, the outcome could be just devastating. So I was wondering Ed's perspective on that. And then I was wondering also, too, Ed, going back to 1995, unusually hot, prolonged summer, was there any prediction on that? Did anybody see that coming? Was that just an anomaly, or did things set up exactly right? Because I just remember, especially going back to Chicago, it just had a devastating effect on the population. And I'll go ahead and ring off and listen off there. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Good questions. The first one, the caller is correct and his friends are incorrect. Chicago can be hit by a devastating tornado. When you think about it, a tornado does hit a small percentage of the landscape. Any tornado is not going to take out a large percentage of the landscape. So anybody in central Illinois, northern Illinois, could be hit by a tornado, but your odds of being hit, your house taking a direct hit, are still relatively small. But the odds are that it can happen too. You know, it's one of those things. And Chicago has been hit by tornadoes. I don't recall any in the Loop, since the Loop has been built up big, but that doesn't mean it can't hit. But when you think of the Loop itself, the square mileage of the Loop is very, very small. But there have been tornadoes in the city of Chicago. You can go back to 1967. There was a devastating tornado that went through Oak Lawn and then right through the south side of Chicago on a Friday afternoon rush hour. People were killed out on the roads in the Chicago area during rush hour. So it wasn't in the Loop, but it did get into the south side. Right during rush hour. So tornadoes can and will hit cities. In the last 15 years or so, there's been a devastating tornado right in downtown Fort Worth. It didn't knock the skyscrapers down, but some skyscrapers had almost all of the glass blown out of them. And for days afterwards, glass was falling to the street from high above. They had to close downtown Fort Worth down. A smaller tornado went right through part of downtown Miami, Nashville, Tennessee, the south edge of Oklahoma City with that devastating tornado in 1999 that went through a populated area on May 3rd of 99. So bottom line is, tornadoes can and do hit cities, and it's a myth that the urban heat island does something. In fact, that has never made sense to me, because we were just talking about solar heating helps build up storms. If anything, I would think the heat island would be a source of heat that might help aid in the development of storms. Now, what I do think does happen is some of the weak tornadoes tend to break up near cities, the very small, weak ones that don't have much of a dynamical structure aloft. And that would be due more to the frictional force of the wind flow of a very weak tornado being disturbed by reaching an area where there's buildings and such. But that would be with the very weakest tornadoes, and nothing to do with the bigger, stronger tornadoes. Strong and violent tornadoes do not care whether they're in the rural areas or the city. They're just going to go where they go, and the storms are going to be strong enough that they're not going to be influenced really by the landscape. As far as the other question, 1995, I don't really remember the forecast going into 1995, but what this caller is referring to is there was a devastating heat wave in 1995, and hundreds died in Chicago. Yeah. And what was really extraordinary about that heat wave was, when we like to say anyway, when we feel uncomfortable in the summer, it wasn't so much the heat as the humidity. Humidity levels were extraordinarily high in July of 1995, and the dew point temperature is over 80 degrees, just to put in perspective for those who know dew point temperatures. So it's one of those things. I don't think that particular heat wave was forecast months in advance, but I think there was, you know, going into it days in advance, that it was going to be an extraordinarily hot and humid period.
Mm-hmm. And as far as, again, going back to what you're talking about before, though, is as far as this, for example, if someone's saying, well, wonder, what do we know about this summer? You're saying at this point, it's so far out, so it's you toss a coin, and you could be right one way or the other. We just don't know.
Well, you need a three-sided coin, really, the above average, near average, or below just, average.
Yeah, okay. All right, very good. Well, I hope that gets to the questions of the caller. Our guest here this morning, again, Ed Kieser, our chief meteorologist. And if you have weather questions, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's someone to talk with next in Champaign. Line one, hello.
Hello.
Yes.
A couple of years ago, Woods Hole Institute came out with what they called a theory of thermaline circulation, which they said, in effect, the melting of the ice caps and areas in the north would affect the conveyor belt of weather that comes along the east coast of the United States and the western coast of Europe. Can you tell me if that theory has been tested or found out, or is it just something that was theorized and never really came to pass?
Well, that question's a little bit out of my area of expertise. I can say that there are a lot of theories about impacts due to climate change, and some of them can't really be proven until they start happening. And I think with that particular one, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm just reading and talking to people like everyone else, so I'm not the expert on it, but I think the theory was that as the ice lid, there would be less salinity of the water in the Atlantic Ocean, and that would change where the Gulf Stream goes, and it would not go up toward Europe, and that would make England and Ireland much colder. I don't think there's any evidence of that happening yet. I don't think there's any evidence. I've read nothing yet that the Gulf Stream is getting weaker or that the ocean is becoming less salty, but that is the theory, and time will tell on that. But beyond that, I don't have any comments because that's out of my area.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller. This is someone listening in over in Indiana this morning. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I guess I'd like to get on the urban myth routine. Now, I grew up as a young boy in Monticello, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Has two lakes. They're artificial, put up by public service electric company way back when. And I remember as a child growing up, I said, you don't have to worry about tornadoes around here, and tornadoes never strike near bodies of water. Well, I think it was in 70 or 71, the town was practically destroyed, and every house I lived in was leveled.
I could tell you the date, the exact date.
Yeah. And went over to Ohio. I mean, it just did a regular mess of everything. And I remember when I finally got back, I was down in North Carolina at the time going to graduate school. And I remember when I got back home, I asked people, and there were still young people saying tornadoes never hurt large bodies of water. So I was wondering if you know, when you come up through the ranks of the meteorologists, they give you these myths, and, you know, this is silly and all that. But I was sort of interested in how in the world they start. There must be some sort of, like, you know, they say some fact to it somewhere. And I've made just anecdotal inquiries around. I've never come across anybody except in this area that ever heard of that one. So I just want to throw that out with the other one about the other fellow I had a few minutes ago. Thanks a lot. Another excellent program, David.
All right. Bye. Well, thank you.
Well, I can tell you, Monticello, Indiana was devastated by a tornado on April 3rd, 1974 as part of the super outbreak of tornadoes. That was the worst outbreak of tornadoes on record in the United States. And I believe there were 148 tornadoes in a 24-hour period in the U.S. That outbreak actually started in Illinois. There were tornadoes in Decatur, Tolono, around Homer, Anchor, over in Vermilion County. There are a few fatalities in Illinois, but that day the tornadoes really got cranked up as the whole system pushed eastward. And there was a long-track tornado that went from southwest to northeast through Indiana, right through Monticello. Monticello was the hardest hit by that tornado. I believe it was an F4. There were seven F5 tornadoes in that outbreak, which is extraordinary because we averaged slightly less than one F5 per year, and there were seven in that outbreak. Xenia, Ohio was the hardest hit that day. And there were some F5s around Kentucky and Ohio and also down in Alabama. But as far as getting back to the myth, that is a myth. And those myths are not perpetrated in meteorology school at all. We are not told anything. All of these myths are myths because people make things up. People that don't know what they're talking about really make these things up. You could ask people in Topeka, Kansas before 1966. They were told, well, you never have to worry about a tornado here. And, of course, in Kansas, tornadoes are big. But they had this hill on this edge of town there, and they said, well, tornadoes will not hit this area because that hill will protect us from tornadoes coming in. Well, 1966, a devastating tornado went right over that hill, pretty much took out Washburn University, and I don't think anybody in Topeka, Kansas is talking about that myth some 40 years later. That myth is gone. And as far as the cities have been hit, and tornadoes have crossed rivers. Some say, oh, it's not going to go over a big river. The Tri-State Tornado of 1925 crossed both the Mississippi River and the Wabash River. You can even get tornadoes in mountainous areas. It's more rare, but back in 1987, a tornado crossed the Continental Divide in Yellowstone Park. It can happen. So I think basically anybody that says a tornado cannot occur here because it's a city or it's near a large body of water. And by the way, those lakes in Indiana, they may look big if you're just driving by them, but in the grand scheme of things, they're not that big. Lake Michigan is big.
Well, that's
are small enough lakes that maybe, again, they would influence what we would call an F0 or now an EF0 tornado, but not anything as powerful as what happened in 1974, because those are storms where the atmosphere above, the dynamics of the atmosphere were such that those storms are going to form regardless of what was on the ground.
Yeah. When the caller did ask the question about the tornado hitting Chicago, I guess I did find myself wondering whether the presence of the lake would do anything, any somehow affect the dynamics of the atmosphere to the extent that it might have an effect one way or another.
Probably, well, most storms move in a general west-east fashion, and the lake is to the east of Chicago. So I think if there's any influence on the lake, it would be more on the other side, on the Michigan side. And they do get some devastating storms on the Michigan side and sometimes some small tornadoes. But come to think of it, I don't recall any big tornadoes on the west coast of Michigan, which would be the east side of Lake Michigan. They sometimes get the squall lines with widespread damaging winds coming across the lake and inland. There was I think it was back in 1998, there was a what we call a derecho, which is a line of storms with widespread wind damage, and it moved across Wisconsin, right across Lake Michigan, and all the way across Lower Michigan, just taking out power to tens of thousands of customers all across Lower Michigan. You know, went through Grand Rapids and then over to the Flint and Detroit areas, and that storm went right across Lake Michigan. And sometimes in those storms, you'll get little spin-ups or tornadoes, so they'll occur. But the bottom line is I don't think Chicago is protected from tornadoes by Lake Michigan because the big tornadoes would be coming in from the west, not the east.
Mm. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Our guest is our chief meteorologist for WILL, Ed Kieser. We're talking a little bit about severe storms, the kind that we will be expecting to see now in the next couple of months. This is Severe Storm Preparedness Week in both Illinois and Indiana, and the governments, the two states, have set this time aside to encourage people just to think about the fact that, yes, tornado could come their way, and you ought to think about what you're going to do if that should happen. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers if you're on a call here with questions. Another caller here, someone in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I want to first off thank you all for the wonderful weather coverage that you provide.
Thank you.
And my question today is related. I'm originally from Texas and familiar with wall clouds, and I was wondering if you could expand on the significance or correlation of wall clouds to tornado formation and severe weather.
Okay, I can talk a little bit about a wall cloud. Wall clouds occur in a thunderstorm. They're really just a lowered part of the cloud base of a thunderstorm, and there's rotation. The whole wall cloud rotates, so call it a lowering. It's often a couple miles wide. It's not a tornado itself, but there is rotation there, and that's where the updraft of the storm is. That's where air is rising into the storm. So it's a lowered cloud base that rotates and usually rotates in a counterclockwise direction. And from a wall cloud, oftentimes that's where a tornado will form. So whenever a spotter, a storm chaser sees a wall cloud, they will watch it very closely because that is likely where a tornado will form. Now, not all tornadoes have wall clouds. There's some thunderstorms we've seen where a tornado will come down without a wall cloud, and not all wall clouds will produce tornadoes. In fact, many do not, but many tornadoes do come out of the wall cloud.
Thank you very much.
I hope that answers it.
All right. Well, again, other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And again, here's another call on our line number two right here. Go ahead.
Hi.
Yes.
When I lived in Florida, just to help dispel the myth about tornadoes over water, aren't water spouts tornadoes over water?
Yeah, they are. They are tornadoes over water, and tornadoes can occur over water. I think what some were suggesting is that you don't usually get the big devastating tornadoes because of water, but you're right. Yeah, for even some of the smaller ones, there can be tornadoes over water, and indeed that those are water spouts. You're correct.
When I lived in Venice, Florida, I remember, actually, I saw a water spout. I was on the beach. I wasn't supposed to be. The sirens were going off, but I wanted to go see what was going on. Silly me. And out in the bay was this big spout of water. And I thought, well, I guess better go home.
Yeah. So you weren't standing out on the jetties there in Venice, were you?
No, I was south of the jetties.
Okay. Well, yeah, they do occur. And in that area, Florida is an area where a lot of water spouts are observed. And sometimes they will occur without thunderstorms. It is similar, I guess, to some of the dust devils that we have over the dry land of Illinois. Sometimes you don't see the dust devils unless they're dry enough, but you can get circulation just from warm air rising. And sometimes you can get water spouts without a thunderstorm. Sometimes you'll get them with a thunderstorm down there.
Well,
but
this one persisted, though, for quite a while. So, I mean, and the Gulf's a pretty big body of water. So
oh, yeah. Well, and the other thing, too, along those lines, yeah, hurricanes, which, of course, form over tropical waters, the oceans, the Gulf of Mexico, most hurricanes do produce tornadoes. So there's tornadoes and hurricanes over the water and inland. So you can live near water and get a tornado, most certainly. But some of the big devastating tornadoes, the violent tornadoes, typically do not come off the water.
Okay. I just wanted to point that out.
Well, I appreciate that. That's good for our other listeners here that haven't lived near a body of water, that they do indeed occur over water. Yeah. Thank you.
Again, thanks. And other questions, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And I was looking at some statistics that came from the Office of the National Weather Service in Lincoln. And one thing here that I think is really worth mentioning is they say that since 2003, 81% of all severe weather events, and this includes the damaging winds, tornadoes, and large hail, 81% in central and southeast Illinois had advance warning from the Weather Service, and they say that the average lead time was 17 minutes. And I think if one thing, if anything, you can say about severe weather is that we have gotten better at identifying severe situations and then being able to tell people who are in the path of those storms that you should take shelter. So that I in our part of the country, the other thing here I think it was really interesting is they say of the top 15 counties in Illinois with the most tornadoes, 10 of them are in central or eastern Illinois. So the possibility of having a tornado where we live, it's significant. So I guess that all comes down to me to when we say there is a dangerous situation, certainly when we say that there is a warning,
mm-hmm.
that people should take it seriously. Take cover.
And the warnings are now, we're going to probably be actually, unfortunately, interrupting broadcasts more than in the past, and that's because the warnings are going to be smaller in size. They're not issuing warnings for whole counties anymore, unless it's a widespread mm-hmm. windstorm with multiple tornadoes. They're going to, the warnings are going to be more precise. So pay attention to the list of towns when we give them. And if you are in or near that town, because there's a lot of rural areas in between towns, take cover. But for example, instead of just saying tornado warning for Champaign County, it might be northern Champaign County, including Fisher and Thomasboro and Rantoul, Penfield and Gifford and so on, and Ludlow and all the mm-hmm. other towns up that way. But Champaign-Urbana would not be in that warning, and certainly Pisotum and Philo and Sydney wouldn't be in that warning. So they're going to be a little more precise, which is good to have the precision so you really know whether you're in it or not. But on the other hand, when there's multiple storms, that means there will be more new warnings coming out because they're smaller in size.
Yeah. One other thing, and then I got another caller here I want to get to. We talked a little bit earlier. I mentioned the fact that in recent years, some of the most devastating storms in terms of loss of life, tornadoes, have come at night. And the reason a lot of people have been killed is that they were in bed in their homes asleep, and they didn't know it was there until it was right on top of them. What now are you and the Weather Service recommending that people should do so that they will get, when there are warnings, they're going to get the word?
You want to get a tone alert weather radio with what's called SAME technology, S-A-M-E, and that would be on the box. SAME just means specific area message encoding. And the reason I say SAME, get one of those. It costs a little more, but you can program the weather radio to just your county so that when the obnoxious tone goes off in the middle of the night, and it's got to be obnoxious to wake you up, right. It's for your county. Right. And some of the fancier ones, you can even program it for just the type of advisory, too. So maybe if you live on high ground and aren't worried about floods, you could just program it for tornadoes and severe thunderstorms. And and I want to mention severe thunderstorm warnings, just because it's not a tornado warning doesn't mean you are out of the woods for trouble, because some of the straight line winds are over 100 miles per hour and can do some serious damage. So basically, you want to at least protect yourself from tornadoes and severe thunderstorms. So the same technology, tone alert weather radios, they cost Well, there's a variety of costs. It's going to be at least $30, $30 or $40, and you can go on up from there. But mm-hmm. that's a good thing for everybody to have in this part of the country.
Right. Yeah, it's good that the ones that they have now are a little bit more sophisticated. I think in the past, sometimes people have complained. They'd said this thing goes off in the middle of the night, and it's for two counties away from here or something. And
right.
You know, I don't really need to know that.
Well, what happens is the Weather Service will issue warnings mm-hmm. wherever you happen to live, from whatever counties are covered by that transmitter. For example, the Champaign Weather Radio Station will give warnings for 9 counties, and it will send a tone alert out for 9 counties. And if you have a less sophisticated weather radio, it's going to go off anytime there's a warning in any of those 9 counties, from Ford County to the north, down to Coles County to the south, DeWitt County to the west, all the way to Vermilion County to the east. So, yeah. You could have a storm 50 miles away, not heading toward your house, and it'll wake you up. But if you have the same technology and you live in Piatt County, you just program in Piatt County, and it's only going to alert you if Piatt County is put under the warning.
Right. Okay, good to know about. Let's talk with somebody in Charleston here. Line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I have a question. It's kind of what you've been talking about. I live in a mobile home, and I have a First Alert weather radio, and it has numbers 1 through 7 on the weather band at the top, but I can't find anything in the literature which tells me what I should be listening to for my area.
Okay. Well, I don't have the internet in front of me. So you aren't getting any reception on any of those numbers, because I'm sure 1 through 7 is just different frequencies. The weather radio stations operate on 7 different frequencies, so they don't overlap on the fringes. I know WXJ76 out of Champaign broadcast at a frequency of 162.55 megahertz, which would probably be number 7.
Okay, that's the only thing I've ever got anything on is on the number 7. So I just wasn't sure what it should be set at all the time.
Well, if whichever one you get your best reception, some people live in between stations and can get more than one. But I know WXJ76 does put out tone alerts for Coles County, which is where you live. So I know you're on the fringe of their reception area. So if you've got spotty reception, you might try to get an antenna for it or something. But number 7 would be the frequency of the Champaign station, because they operate anywhere between 162.40 and 162.55 megahertz, and most people don't want to pay attention to those numbers. So most of the radios have that 1 through 7 option there, and those are just different frequencies. So if you took your radio and drove across a state, you would probably pick up reception on one of those other numbers.
Okay.
That's what that means. But it's good that you have a weather radio if you live in a mobile home, because mobile homes are prone to tornado damage. About half of all tornado fatalities in the United States occur to people in mobile homes when the tornado strikes. So I always say, if you live in a mobile home, just pay close attention to the weather, because that's one thing you're at risk of.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks
Other
for calling.
Questions are welcome. We got about 5 minutes with our meteorologist, Ed Kieser, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I want to make sure that if there's any you want to review any of the basics.
Oh, yeah. We haven't really.
We really haven't done that. I want to make sure that we really do that.
Well, some of this I say every year, but the one thing for tornado safety, obviously you want to be inside a sturdy building. You don't want to be caught outdoors. We could tell you what to do if you're caught outdoors, but assuming you find a good sturdy building, you always want to go to the lowest floor in the building, because the tornado winds are stronger the higher up you go. And you want to get into the middle of the building, in a small room if possible, or under a staircase. You want to put as many walls between you and the tornado as possible. So go to the lowest floor and put as many walls between you and the tornado as possible. You do not want to be in a mobile home when a tornado strikes. You don't want to be in a motor vehicle, an automobile or pickup truck or anything like that, because tornadoes can pick them up. So if you're under a threat of a tornado, try to get to a sturdy building. If that's not possible, Your last ditch effort is to get in a ditch, lie flat, and cover your head with your hands. You don't want to get under a bridge overpass. You know, that's been the one myth of the last decade and a half, because of some video where people did that, and they were very lucky. But the winds of a tornado get stronger as you go up. You could get blown out of that bridge overpass. Also, debris can go flying through there. You don't want to block the interstate parking under a bridge. You just don't want to do that. So those are some of the basic tips. And a watch means watch out. A warning means the danger is there.
All right. Yeah, I think that's, again, though, it's good to mention that, because I think as long as we've been doing this, people still get confused about what the difference is between a watch and a warning.
Yeah, a watch means watch out. That means conditions are favorable for storms. That could, if it's a tornado watch, that could produce tornadoes and other severe weather, such as large hail and damaging winds. A tornado warning means a tornado has been sighted, or Doppler radar shows very strong rotation and a tornado is imminent.
Okay. Next is line number one in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
I have a question that I've been wondering about for a number of years. I've lived in Champaign for quite a while, and I've heard from a number of people who kind of have this theory, and I wondered if you ever heard about it, that some people think Champaign is kind of positioned in kind of a small area where it's kind of down low, kind of dipped down. And I've heard from a number of people who say because of that, Champaign will not is unlikely to have a tornado because it would sort of go around. Have you ever heard that? Anyone say that?
Oh, I've heard people say it, and it's absolutely false.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely false. Don't believe it, but I've heard people say it. And that goes along to what I was talking about in Topeka, Kansas. It's pretty similar there. We have a hill to the west, and we're kind of down low, and tornado will never hit here. Well, that was until 1966 when the big tornado hit there. The reason Champaign hasn't been hit by a big tornado really is just the random nature of tornadoes, and that they hit a small part of the landscape. It's just more of an odds based on the size of a tornado versus the size of the landscape. That's about it. And I worry, you know, some year Champaign's going to get hit and hit hard. Don't know whether it's this year or 20 years from now or 100 years from now, but it will happen at some point.
Right.
And in 1996, Southeast Urbana was hit pretty hard by an F3 tornado.
Right. Do I have time for just one follow-up question?
Sure.
And maybe you've already covered this. I don't know, because I just turned the radio. I have a house with a basement, and I know that, you know, theoretically, I mean, that is the safest place to be. But I also worry about, you know, the house, you know, actually just collapsing and then just sort of being stuck or trapped and all, you know, like in the basement. And that happens fairly commonly, right? That a house would just go ahead and collapse.
Yeah, but
you could be trapped.
Well, you may end up being trapped, but just be trapped under something sturdy, such as your staircase. And that way, you know, rescuers will come. It's better to be trapped but uncrushed than it would be to be upstairs and blown away.
Right. So it's still the safest place to go, even though that could happen.
Yeah, well, what we say is you got to still get under something sturdy, because if you just go and stand in the middle of your basement, the house can fall on you. Unfortunately, we've seen evidence of that a few years back in Utica, Illinois. There was a devastating tornado that's near Star Rock State Park. A bunch of people went into the basement of a tavern, and some were killed when one of the beams holding up the tavern came down right on them. So try to get under something sturdy.
A table or something really heavy.
Yes.
You should try to get under there.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Thank you. We'll get at least one more. We have someone here in Paris, Illinois, I believe, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
Mr. Ed?
Yes.
I would talk to you a few years back when you were over there at St. Mary's of the Woods College.
Oh, yeah. I remember doing a tornado show several years ago there.
And but my father was mentioning about the devastation in Charleston, Illinois.
Uh-huh.
And we lived in Hume at that time. And they found records from the Charleston courthouses about, land records and everything when they went out to plant corn the next spring.
Well, that's not surprising. That was the devastating 1917 tornado, probably, that went through Mattoon and Charleston.
I don't remember what year it was.
I think it was May 26, 1917, I believe.
Okay.
So that would be another example.
It traveled those 30 miles up there, and it was in the fields.
Yeah, there's been reports of records from many tornadoes carried sometimes more than 100 miles away. People's checkbooks landing in yards. Even after the tornado has ended, the debris, some of it's up in the clouds and carried by the upper air winds, maybe 100 miles sometimes when you have a devastating tornado like that.
I didn't realize it traveled that far.
Some can do that.
Well, again, I appreciate the story.
Thank you.
Again, you know, that's yet another example for those people who have heard that story that says, oh, tornadoes don't hit cities and towns. Well, in fact, they do. And in response to that question that the caller had at the beginning of the program, you had a long list of some of them very big cities that have been seriously hit by big tornadoes. So there's nothing to the idea that a city can't be hit by a tornado.
And I got something in that's not tornado related, but Mike Sola just handed me this little story here. The state climatologist says last month was the wettest February in Illinois since records started being kept in 1895. The 4.48 inches of precipitation Illinois received in February was 2.49 inches above average, and that's an average for the whole state. And that's according to Jim Angel of the Illinois State Water Survey in Champaign. February was colder than average, too. The statewide average temperature for the month was 25.2 degrees, which is 5.2 degrees below average. So February was a cold month.
So we were talking, if people think, yeah, it's been sort of a cold, wet winter.
Yeah.
It has been.
And winter here was wetter than average, as we know, in December and January, plus February. So it was the third wettest winter on record for the state of Illinois. The state received an average of 11.32 inches this winter, which is 4.63 inches above average. So that's a little timely information there, since that's how we started the show.
All right. Thank you, Mike Sola. Thank you, Ed Kieser, for being here. Were you going to be doing a tornado?
Yes, show? That was the last thing I wanted to mention. I wanted to get that in. Thursday, April 10th, 7 p.m., Beckman Institute Auditorium here on the U of I campus. So same place we've had it in many of the past years here. So Beckman Institute, Thursday, April 10th.
All right. I'm sure we'll be talking more about that as it gets closer.
I'm sure it'll get mentioned at least once or twice.
WILO programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe, offering continental breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., lunches from 11:30 to 1, Monday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated and newly remodeled on the second floor of Bevere Hall at the corner of Gregory and Goodwin in Urbana. That's it for us. We want you to stay tuned, though. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine, and Celeste Quinn is the host.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk with journalist Carl Cannon. He is co-author of the book Reagan's Disciple, George W. Bush's Troubled Quest for a Presidential Legacy. That conversation takes place this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Let's turn our attention now to the commodity markets in Kansas City. March wheat trading at 11.68, up 3. In Chicago, March wheat trading at 11.23, that contract up 27. July, 10.73, up 26. March corn, 5.54 and a half, down 2 and a half. May, 5.66 and a quarter, down 3 quarters. July, 5.78, down 1. December, 5.79, up 1 and 3 quarters. March beans, 14.44, down 46 and a half. May, 14.67, down 41 and a half. July, 14.78, down 41 and a half. And November, 13.61, down 30 and a half. March meal, $364.30, down $11.50. March oil, $64.60, down $1.95.